6 months ago that you can apply a similar method to transforming plastic bottles into paracetamol as well. So if we can do these two things, we think really there's endless opportunities to make a whole variety of medications and, you know, potentially other industrial products that are currently made from fossil oil, from plastic waste and other waste sources as well. I think the really cool thing about this as well is that when you take Parkinson's medication, L-DOPA, it's actually transformed into dopamine in the brain. That's how it works medically. And that's, you know, the happy hormone that sort of gives us that, you know, sort of in our brain. So actually in this way, you're turning plastic waste into happiness, which I think is rather poetic. I think it's a nice way to think about this.
what a theme on which to end, a happy one. Thank you very much indeed, Professor Stephen Wallace. Well, that's it from me today. I'm sharing a studio now with Jane Garvey and Fee Glover. I'm all a tremor.
Must be a real, it's a low point for you, Mark.
No,
I tell you what, Mark,
don't say
you're hiding it well.
No, I'm all a tremor. It's goodbye from me and momentarily over to them.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio, the voice of the times.
Thank you very much, Mark. There's no need for anyone to be afraid, is there?
We're only tiny.
We're absolutely minute, almost invisible to the naked eye. It's 2 o'clock. It's Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio.
But there are two of us. Coming up on the programme today, the veteran foreign correspondent Barbara Slavin will tell us who the key players are in Iran right now. That's after Israel saying it's killed two more of the country's leaders. Some students living in Canterbury will be vaccinated against meningitis following the outbreak there. We'll talk more about that with our resident GP, Dr. Rachel Ward. Our big guest at 3:30 is the presenter and psychologist Dr. Sian Williams on her new book, The Power of Anxiety. And researchers say sharks not only have good friends, but they like to go swimming with them. Isn't that a pleasing little story? We'll find out more soon.
Here's the news at 2 from Stuart Willey.
Jane, thank you. Good afternoon. Pharmacies say they've seen a surge in bookings for the meningitis vaccine, as the health secretary says the outbreak in Kent is unprecedented and developing rapidly. Two young people have died so far, with 15 others seriously ill. 700 doses of antibiotics have been given out, and Wes Streeting says he's looking at the rules for who gets vaccines. He says while the strain is potentially lethal, it doesn't spread easily.
The bacteria is passed to others after a long period of close contact. For example, with living with someone in shared accommodation, through prolonged kissing, or sharing vapes and drinks.
Streeting told MPs the outbreak is linked to a nightclub in Canterbury. Israel claims to have assassinated a senior Iranian regime official, Eli Larijani. As security chief, he was a key advisor to the former supreme leader and was last seen in public on Friday. The IDF also says they killed the head of the domestic besieged militia, Gholam Reza Soleimani. Iran hasn't confirmed either man's death. Dr. Lina Khatib is a Middle East analyst with Chatham House.
Israel is pursuing the same approach it pursued regarding Hezbollah. Now doing the same basically in Iran. With Hezbollah, there was a systemic campaign to get rid of the leadership of the group, starting at the very top and moving down several layers of leadership. After the Ayatollah, Ali Larijani was the second most powerful man in Iran.
The security service, MI5, has apologised and will pay compensation to a woman abused by a neo-Nazi informant. Director General Sir Ken McCallum says they've settled her legal action without admission of liability. The agency has faced criticism from judges for misleading the courts after the agent was accused of coercive control and of attacking the woman with a machete. Gerry Adams has said in a witness statement that he was never a member of the IRA and did not sanction or play any other part in the Old Bailey bombing or any other bombing. The former president of Sinn Féin is in the High Court, where he's also said membership of his party did not equate with being part of the IRA. Reform UK says it would cut £200 from people's energy bills. The party's economics spokesman, Robert Jenrick, says VAT on bills would be axed, and he says environmental additions would go as well.
We're going to get rid of the green taxes and levies that Ed Miliband has loaded onto your energy bills. Taxes and levies that mostly, they just go to the energy companies. Together, these are going to save £100 £115 off the average energy bill.
He says the rest of the £200 cut would come from dropping VAT. And potholes have been called a national disgrace by an industry group. The Asphalt Industry Alliance says damaged roads in England and Wales are resurfaced on average just once every 97 years, with costs hitting a record £18.6 billion. For a news bulletin when you want it, search for the Times Radio News Briefing on the Times Radio app.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, on the Times Radio app, online, and on your smart speaker.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wix Kitchens and Bathrooms.
Hello, a very good afternoon. The sun is beaming down here in London town. I hope it's shining for you this afternoon. It's Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio until 4 o'clock. And between now and four, a new military partnership between the UK and Ukraine. We've got some big news from the ocean deep. Bull sharks have got best friends. I'm not sure about that story. And the idea that they go swimming together, well, realistically, not going to go shopping, are they? You know what I mean?
I know.
Am I being cynical?
No, you're not being cynical, but I think it's our go-to place, isn't it, this afternoon to try and take our mind off
something.
All the other stuff in the world. So if sharks are being friendly to each other, we will investigate.
OK, if you were born between 1965 and 1980...
Oh, that's me.
How does your pension look?
Not great.
Can you ever afford to retire?
No. You're stuck with me.
Excellent news. We're talking about Gen X and their pension prospects on the programme today. Our resident GP, Dr. Rachel Ward, on the really important and very tragic story of the meningitis outbreak in Kent. All you need to know from Dr. Rachel this afternoon. Vassos Alexander on sport. We're talking cricket today. We'll probably have a little chat about the World Cup as well. And our big guest is, after 3.30...
It's Dr. Siân Williams. Now, you might know Siân because she was on the BBC Breakfast sofa for many years. She presented some of the biggest outside broadcasts at the BBC over the last 20 years or so. But she did take a little bit of time alongside that career to retrain as a clinical psychologist. That's where the doctor comes from. And her latest book is called The Power of Anxiety, How to Ride the Worry Wave. And in it, she is trying to provide some very helpful and useful and practical advice as to what to do with the anxiety that all of us have in our lives. I mean, it wouldn't be a life without anxiety. But for many people, it seems to be overwhelming and it can be part of a descent into something incredibly dark if it's not handled the right way. So this is a handbook to turn your life around or to just better understand all of the emotions around anxiety. So it is very helpful. And she details some of her own very anxious episodes as well, which is quite a peek behind the curtains of very stressful live television, Jane.
Yeah. So the bottom line is anxiety, not always a bad thing.
Not always a bad thing at all. So it's part of what drives us to notice things around us. A feeling that you're going to survey a situation and you're going to be worried about it. I mean, that's there for a reason in humans, isn't it? Because it identifies danger. So it's by no means bad at all part of the human condition. But it's definitely an epidemic now in its clinical sense.
And the pension story I mentioned, this is all based on research conducted by the Social Market Foundation. And honestly, this is serious stuff, as lots of people listening will recognise. Over half, we're told, 54% of Gen Xers are heading for an inadequate retirement income. A warning from think tanks, and people need to get a wiggle on and do something. But of course, it's easy to say, not always easy to do. One helpful thing would be to carry on working, as my colleague Fee is going to do. But not everybody has a job where you can sit down and chat. Some people have got proper physical jobs that are incredibly difficult to do and quite gruelling in later life.
Yep. It's a very worrying story, isn't it?
It is really. Any thoughts on that, you can tell us. 0333 003 2353. That's the WhatsApp. Now to the most read stories on the Times website this afternoon.
They are so far this afternoon, Jane. In at number three, mother who wrote children's book about husband's death, guilty of his murder. The woman from Utah wrote the book to help her sons cope with the loss of their father. Her trial was told that she was $4.5 million in debt when in fact she poisoned her husband. The second most read story is Iran latest. Iranian security chief Ali Larijani has been killed, Israel claims. One of the most powerful figures in the regime was assassinated in an airstrike on an apartment. That's according to Israel, but Tehran hasn't confirmed his death. We will talk about Iran in the second hour of this programme. The most read piece on the Times website, Banksy's real name revealed in 26-year-old police report. This is an investigation by the Reuters news agency, which links the graffiti artist to a misdemeanour by a guy called Robin Gunningham in New York in the year 2000. All of that might change, though, because we do have some breaking news this afternoon, which is a resignation over in Washington, and it's the resignation of Joseph Kent, Joe Kent, director of the National Counterterrorism Center. And in his letter to President Donald Trump, the man who had appointed him, he is pretty vicious in his condemnation of President Trump's current foreign policy towards Iran. Just to read you a little bit of his letter: after much reflection, I've decided to resign from my position as director of the National Counterterrorism Center effective today. I cannot in good conscience support the ongoing war in Iran. Iran posed no imminent threat to our nation, and it is clear that we started this war due to pressure from Israel and its powerful American lobby. He goes on to talk more about that lobby, and he also says, as a veteran who deployed to combat 11 times and as a Gold Star husband who lost my beloved wife Shannon in a war manufactured by Israel, I cannot support sending the next generation off to fight and die in a war that serves no benefit to the American people. Now, it is worth pointing out that there have always been questions about Mr. Kent himself over his ties to white nationalists and employment with what's considered to be a pretty shady military contractor. So there's definitely some depth to the man's career history, which we shall pursue, but it is a stinging rebuke of President Trump's decisions over Iran over the last 2 weeks.
Yeah, very, very interesting development. Perhaps we'll tell you a little bit more about Mr. Kent, because I think it might be fair to say he had some links to some deeply unpleasant people, notably the white nationalist activist Nick Fuentes. Anyway, he's quit. So cracks in MAGA. I suspect this one could run and run, couldn't it? Big story, this.
And you can read all of those articles on thetimes.com. You do need your digital subscription. All of the pages have been constantly updated. It's a great place to find your very latest news. If you don't have a subscription, get one. You simply go to thetimes.com/subscribe.
Right, we're going to talk now to Larissa Brown, the Times defence editor. This is because Ukraine and the UK are unveiling a new military partnership. President Zelensky is in Downing Street today. Now, this pact aims to boost our defence against weapons like the suicide drones used in their tens of thousands by Russia and Iran. The NATO leader, Mark Rutte, is also taking part in the meetings at Number 10 on the future of the war in Ukraine. Larissa, a good afternoon to you.
Good afternoon.
So this sounds as though Ukraine's helping us and we're helping them. Is that right?
I think that's the point here. And they have been saying this behind the scenes for years now, that we need to learn from the Ukrainians as much as they do need to learn from us. The point is that the Ukrainians are there on the front line every single day, and we've not been in a similar situation for many years now. And you can see in the Iran conflict at the moment, the Ukrainians are being relied on to help with our security out there. And we've got Ukrainian troops now embedded with different countries in the Gulf, all trying to share their expertise on how to counter these Shahed drones, which are the drones, the Iranian drones, that have been given to Russia in huge quantities over the last few years.
So this is actually a significant opportunity for Ukraine and for President Zelensky, isn't it?
I think it is. It's a huge opportunity for them to show that they can really offer something to countries like us and to the Americans. And I thought what was quite interesting was the Ukrainian foreign minister said on Twitter today that the perceptions have changed of Ukraine in the last few weeks. And Ukraine's no longer a country just asking for support, but also a security contributor for Europe and other regions. And 11 countries have actually requested Ukraine support in the last couple of weeks as they've come under those drone attacks.
But of course, we also know that Russia is hugely benefiting from the conflict. And that's not likely to bring about an end to the war between Russia and Ukraine, is it?
No, and the experts that I've been speaking to have been saying that Putin is emerging as a winner in this conflict, because not only are you seeing vast amounts of American kit and kit from Europe being used in the Middle East now, this is all equipment that could potentially have gone to Ukraine instead, but you're also seeing Putin benefit potentially greatly in the long run of the from the price of oil rising, and that and the Americans have talked about easing sanctions even further on the Russians, and this will also make it a lot harder for countries like us to crack down on that shadow fleet, and that was something that we were trying to really step up in the last few months. So it's a, it's potentially a big big win for Putin, all of this.
Right, it's bizarre, isn't it? Because potentially it's a big win for both sides in that conflict. So we're in a slightly a position we couldn't have anticipated. I don't think, or I certainly couldn't. Mark Rutte is there, head of NATO. Why is he involved today?
He's involved because they're talking about the wider partnership that the Ukrainians could bring, how NATO allies can work together and produce low-cost drones, but also bring in artificial intelligence and use AI in a more clever way that enables countries in NATO to be able to rapidly respond to threats that could emerge from Russia in the future. And I think part of the reason that they're both here today, President Zelensky and Rutte, is to try and put the Ukraine back on the agenda, because we haven't really been talking about it for the last couple of weeks as Iran has kicked off. But I think, you know, they want to make it clear that there is still this war raging in Europe.
Yes, I mean, at the turn of the seasons, there is a spring offensive, isn't there? I nearly said a traditional spring offensive, because this is the... Is it the fifth year?
Yeah, we're in our fifth year.
Yeah, I mean, what is happening on the ground?
That people are concerned that there is a preparation for a spring offensive. We're still in a situation where Russia isn't making any you know significant gains on the battlefield, but over time, you know, Ukraine is struggling and they haven't got the munitions that they need. They're here. In fact, a lot of the MPs are here today in London to try and urge the UK to send more missiles and air defence systems. I mean, that's something that we don't even have enough of ourselves. And I think the Ukrainians are facing huge problems at the moment with Europe and the US wanting to make sure that they've got enough of their significant stockpile, and they don't have the spare equipment to give to the Ukrainians.
Presumably, there'll also be talk today about the possibility of NATO nations helping out in the Strait of Hormuz. But for the moment, there seems to be a general agreement that no, we're not willing to do this. Is that still the case?
Well, the UK is trying to offer up potential options for the Strait of Hormuz, and actually, I'm writing a very lengthy piece today on what those options could be. I mean, we haven't got many warships to actually offer up, and countries like France, the UK, others in Europe are obviously extremely nervous about sending warships to the Strait of Hormuz when the current situation is pretty terrifying with missiles and drone boats, and countries like the UK aren't going to be sending resources there and people there without thinking that it's a proper viable plan which will ensure the safe passage of those commercial vessels while not endangering troops to a degree that isn't palatable here.
Well, I suppose it's an easier case to make, isn't it, for our involvement in Russia-Ukraine, because that is properly on our doorstep. And we rightly, yeah, I think, are involved and have been involved right from the start. It's much less clear that we owe the Americans our help with Iran, bearing in mind that the significant story we've already reported this afternoon, cracks beginning to show in the White House administration.
Yeah, and you'll probably see that some of those views will be shared with those in the UK government, in terms of this war wasn't necessary, it was a war of choice, and does the UK really want to be seen to be joining in and helping the Americans in the Strait of Hormuz for a war that should never have been started? On the other hand, you could see that there's clearly, we should, you know, they might argue the Navy should be protecting British flagged vessels that want to come through that narrow waterway. We have done that in the past. But there are, I think, discussions in government at the moment about the legal implications of joining, because don't forget that a few weeks ago we were having this whole argument about how British bases should be used by the Americans, and the UK government said that it'd be illegal for the US to use those bases for preemptive strikes. Now, so any time that the US aircraft are flying from RAF Fairford at the moment, they're having to justify those strikes
as defensive.
And so if you're then going to get involved in an operation in the Strait of Hormuz, you'll be asking similar questions. What exactly is the role of those ships, and what would they do if they did come under attack? What site, you know, what can they hit back?
And I hope this is right. Would any one oil tanker require another vessel to protect it? Would it work as one-on-one, if you like?
So I was on HMS Montrose, a frigate, in 2019 when it was going through the Strait of Hormuz, carrying out a similar escort mission. And that was one frigate, one warship for three oil tankers. And so that's probably maybe three, but probably even just one, because you're not only protecting now against fast boats and machine guns, you're having to defend against missiles. And you'd also, in terms of what you'd need to send out there, you wouldn't just have one warship. You'd also need air cover from the sky. So you might need jets in the skies to try and find out where missiles are being launched from. So it'd have to be a whole huge operation involving allies working together.
Right, fascinating. I didn't know, realise you'd actually been there. I mean, daft question, but what is it like?
It was weirdly exciting because terrifying. At the time, it was when Trump was in Trump's first term, and they were facing these Iranian fast boats that were coming up to UK ships, and they were effectively harassing them, was what it was called. And they didn't actually, the UK didn't have to fire shots at them or kill anyone, but it was quite like intense exchanges between the Iranians, and they were just trying to make people not feel like it was safe going through the Strait of Hormuz. And this was all, it was a big row about ships going through. We'd seized a vessel that was carrying oil bound for Syria, and then the Iranians had threatened to then take revenge and then seize a British vessel, and they eventually did do that. And so it was really tense times, really tense times.
Larissa, that was fascinating. Thank you very much indeed for your time. I'll let you get back to writing your piece.
Thank you.
That's Larissa Brown. As she said, she's about to head back to her desk and complete that article for thetimes.com. She is the Times defence editor.
It sounds so much like war games, doesn't it? But it's just so blooming serious.
Yeah, it really is.
It's 19 minutes past two. Coming up, we're going to take a completely different turn and ask, would Jaws have had very many shark mates? It's Jane and Fee on Times Radio with Wickes, the experts in kitchens and bathrooms.
Jane Mulkerins on Times Radio.
Join me, Jane Mulkerins, every Saturday afternoon, right here on Times Radio. I'll be bringing you everything from politics to popular culture. We'll have big thinkers on my news panel, a healthy smattering of celebrity, and if you've got a personal dilemma that you just can't solve, bring it here. I've even got an agony aunt / uncle on hand with sage advice.
Jane Mulkerins starts this Saturday from 1 on Times Radio.
McDonald's wraps, all flavour, no mess. No drips on your drip or grease on your shirt. No crumbs on your keyboard or sauce on your dashboard. Just all the flavour of sweet chilli chicken, barbecue and bacon chicken and new Tikka chicken. Wrapped up neat. Served after 11 a.m. Tikka chicken wrap available until the 13th July 26. Fees apply to delivery orders, subject to availability.
AI is only as powerful as the platform it's built into. That's why it's no surprise that more than 85% of the Fortune 500 use the ServiceNow AI platform. While other platforms duct tape tools together, ServiceNow seamlessly unifies people, data, workflows, and AI, connecting every corner of your business. And with AI agents working together autonomously, anyone in any department can focus on the work that matters most. Learn how ServiceNow puts AI to work for people at servicenow.co.uk.
Meet iPhone 17e, a whole lot for a lot less, with an almighty all-powerful A19 chip and Ceramic Shield 2, built to survive this and this, and a 48-megapixel fusion camera with 2x optical quality zoom and next-gen portraits, and double the starting storage of iPhone 16e, and long-lasting battery life for hours and hours of streaming. And you can charge it with USB-C or with MagSafe accessories, and a whole lot more, all for a lot less. Get the new iPhone 17e today. Ceramic Shield 2 on front display. Battery life varies by use. Accessory sold separately. Price compared to iPhone 17 at apple.com/UK.
Coming soon, rowing's greatest rivalry. Live and exclusively on Times Radio.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wickes. Save up to 50% on kitchen units with the Spend and Save offer. And for a limited time, there's an extra 10% off. Terms and minimum spend apply. Find your nearest kitchen showroom at wickes.co.uk.
22 minutes past two. Now, everybody, we're going to build some suspense. Right, we've built the suspense. Sharks are often portrayed as solitary hunters, gliding ominously through the deep in search of their next meal. But new research from the Shark Reef Marine Reserve in Fiji suggests that there could be more to the story. Bull sharks, it turns out, may have best friends and appear to lead surprisingly complex social lives. Let's talk now to Professor David Jacoby, an ecologist at Lancaster University and one of the study's authors. Professor Jacoby, a very good afternoon from us. How are you?
I'm very good, thank you. Thanks for having me on the programme.
Well, it's absolutely our pleasure. This is such an interesting story. It completely busts the trope that sharks are these lone creatures. So tell us more about their sociability.
It does indeed, yeah. And these are sort of large-bodied, coastally associated predators. And yet, when they come to this specific site in Fiji, they seem to show these active social preferences. So they actively seek out other individuals and also actively avoid others as well. So we found that sex was important for structuring the social network, but also size played a big role when you came down to the fine scale interactions. So how individuals that were swimming with each other or swimming towards each other might respond to one another.
Okay. So it's really interesting. Well, it's fascinating. I'm now picturing the sharks as if they're a kind of group of mates meeting up in a bar in Fiji and saying, oh, hello. Yep, I remember you. I like you. I don't like the other one. Is it as simple as that?
I think that's a fairly good analogy, yeah. There's lots of analogies that we can use to our own society as well. So another of the key findings from the study was that middle-aged sharks tend to be much more well socially connected than either very young or older sharks. And it just shows that if you have enough data over a long time, and this is from 150 hours spent underwater watching and observing these animals from the lead author, Natasha Morosi, that if you spend enough time watching them, that you can determine how sociality changes through time and with age as well.
Tell us a bit more about what they're looking for in that friendship.
Yeah, that's a good question. I think in early life, socialising is important, maybe for mitigating conflict with larger individuals. Perhaps in middle life, it might be more useful for informing where to go foraging. So they might follow one another off the reef into deeper water to go feeding. And as I said, these older individuals tend to be more asocial than social, which is really interesting. It's like they have all the experience. They don't need friends anymore.
And is it the same for lady sharks and boy sharks?
Well, we found that males were more well socially connected, which makes a lot of sense, certainly from what we know about how sharks behave reproductively. The males move around a lot more. They're always looking for kind of opportunistic mating opportunities. So they're likely to encounter individuals more often as well. But the ties between females were stronger on average than the males.
Okay, so now I'm picturing this great big shark manosphere and some rather snooty women who think, yeah, we're just going to leave them to it. Let's keep ourselves to ourselves.
That sounds about right.
Okay.
but it evolves through time, and that's what's interesting.
Yeah. So now you know this about sharks. Does it change anything else that we thought about sharks?
Well, it sort of capitalises on this big data set from an ecotourist dive site. So people can go there and dive with these bull sharks. And I think it's helping feed into that narrative, given the fact that we know sharks have declined in huge numbers over the last 50 years through fishing and bycatch. Sharks are now much more valuable alive than they are dead. So we're starting to recognise that fact that we can watch these and observe these beautiful animals in the field and pay to do so. And a lot of people are.
By bycatch, you mean the sharks when they're caught in nets and the fishermen have been after a different type of catch?
Exactly, yes. So unintentional catch through a different fishery for, say, tuna or billfish or something like that.
And how much has that threatened the shark population?
It's decimated the shark population. It's for some of the large-bodied species like this and things like tiger sharks, some of the most sort of iconic species that we can think of from the open ocean, have declined by 80 to 90% in the last 50 to 60 years. So it's had a real impact, along with a whole host of other stresses as well, including climate change.
And tell us a bit more about Fiji and why that is so important to the shark community, if in fact it is.
Well, sharks are really important in the South Pacific. They're a real sort of cultural symbol. They are gods in a lot of cultures as well. And I feel the lead author, Natasha, is best placed to kind of answer this question. She lives out in Fiji. She works there every day. But they're very culturally important and are a really important component of the marine ecosystem as well.
Should we like the shark more, Professor?
We absolutely should like the shark more. I think they often get a bit of a bad rep, but there's clearly a lot more to them than meets the eye.
Okay. So if you were going to resell the shark, you're just doing PR, all new PR for the shark, you definitely wouldn't want Jaws the movie involved, would you?
But, it's another story there.
It is. But it, you know, we see the shark as being the ultimate predator of the sea, don't we? Perhaps that's not backed up at all by the statistics.
Well, don't get me wrong, they're an extremely efficient predator, but there's lots of different species. They feed on all sorts of different things. And let's not forget that they've been on this planet for nearly 450 million years. They've experienced more of life than anything else on the planet. So it's, they've had a long time to fill that ecological niche, and we've just arrived at the last minute and have had quite a big impact on their populations globally.
Yeah. So can you infer at all that there is joy or happiness or reassurance or some kind of emotion like that going on for the sharks when they do meet up again in their great big shark bar?
I really wish we could. They don't give a lot away when you observe them underwater. There's no sort of expression. There is the sort of, our understanding is based on seeing how they position themselves with one another, seeing whether they give way to each other, so whether bigger sharks will take precedent when they swim towards one another. But yeah, underwater they don't give a lot away, so it's hard to know whether they're happy or not, but I'd like to hope they are.
Yes. And does it annoy you at all that people like me want to kind of anthropomorphize these creatures, give them our kind of human emotions in order to understand them better? Is that a slightly kind of foolish thing to be doing?
No, I don't think it is, actually. I think there are certain issues with anthropomorphizing, but it also helps us relate to them as well. And I think that's been part of the problem for a long time now, that people can't relate to this predator that lives under the water that they never really see in person. So I think it doesn't do any harm to kind of sell that different side of them, the cognitive complexity to be able to maintain all these social interactions. I think that's okay.
Mm. Well, it's been a lovely story to read about today. Thank you very much indeed for your time. That is Professor David Jacoby, who is an ecologist at Lancaster University. So the top line is that sharks are mates. They spend a lot of time travelling around underwater, and then they check in to feed you and go, "Oh, right, I haven't seen you, Brian, for ages. How you doing?
Do you want to go for a swim?" And the answer is yes. Right, I'm sort of half convinced. Let us know what you think. Colin sent a rather sexist message.
What?
Male sharks off on their own enjoying the peace and quiet. What a dream, says Colin. Well, there's no peace and quiet for you, Colin, for at least 90 minutes, because we're here until 4 o'clock. But we do have a man taking over at four. Yes, that is the sound of Callum MacDonald. He's a frightening individual, isn't he?
Do you know, if ever there was a theme tune for Callum, it's definitely this chain.
Maybe
played on the bagpipes.
He might be coming in a sec. Right, next. Are you one of the almost 80% of Gen X who haven't got a clue what's in your pension pot? What's a pension pot, you're asking? Well, yes, you'll find out more in a couple of minutes' time. Here are the headlines on Times Radio just after 2:30. Here's Stuart Willie.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio.
Jane, thank you. Good afternoon. Donald Trump's top counter-terrorism official has resigned over the conflict in Iran. Joe Kent says he can't in good conscience back the war, arguing Tehran posed no imminent threat to the United States. In a social media post, he also claimed the war was launched because of pressure from Israel. Earlier, Israel claimed to have assassinated Ali Larijani, Tehran's top security chief. Here, 15 cases of meningitis have now been confirmed in Kent. The health secretary has given an update to MPs after the two young people who died in the county last week. He says health officials will begin a targeted vaccine program aimed at students living in halls of residence. Dr. Eliza Gill from the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine says the jab was only rolled out in 2015.
The absolute risk of meningitis B to young adults outside of this outbreak does remain low. So I don't want to panic kind of all young adults across the country about the fact they were not vaccinated as babies. But this cohort have not got immunity at the moment.
The trade union Unite will have to pay nearly £500,000 for breaching a High Court injunction over the Birmingham bin strike. The union admitted blocking lorries, leaving depots and using slow walking tactics around vehicles during the now 16-month-long dispute. And parts of the UK could see temperatures as high as 20 degrees tomorrow. Western parts of England and Wales are expected to be the warmest and will enjoy prolonged sunshine. Don't forget, you can set the Times Radio News Briefing as your news service on Alexa.
This is Times Radio.
The UK government is backing businesses with access to innovation funding through Horizon Europe. At Albiki Distillery, sustainability is at the heart of how their spirits are made. Dr. Kirsty Black, their master distiller, has pioneered the use of peas as a key ingredient in gin and vodka. They grow peas on their own farm and use them in their spirits instead of traditional grains. Through Horizon Europe, Kirsty was able to collaborate with specialists across Europe. They explored alternative cropping methods, as well as understanding the environmental benefits of using peas and other legumes in spirits. They were then able to reduce and analyse Arbiki's carbon footprint. This helped Arbiki substantiate its climate-positive claims and strengthen its field-to-bottle approach to sustainability. Support from Horizon Europe has played a vital role in ensuring that Arbiki is now one of the world's most sustainable distilleries. To find out more about how your business could benefit from Horizon Europe's innovation funding, visit horizoneurupeuk.org.
Get the day's politics, business and sport every weekday in breakfast from 6:30 a.m.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wix. Let Wix install your new kitchen. Choose from a wide range of kitchens and add the option of installation to your order. For complete peace of mind, all installations include a 2-year workmanship guarantee. Get started by booking a free design appointment at wix.co.uk.
Happy St. Patrick's Day.
Thank you very much. And to you.
Well, I think Celts can celebrate, can't they?
Yeah, definitely.
Of all descriptions. Right, Callum McDonald.
It was one of the strangest mashups we've ever had.
It was. I don't know what it was, but it doesn't matter. It's a beautiful day. Sunshine.
Do you ever sometimes look at what we do and think,
No, I try not. It doesn't bear much scrutiny.
It's not a proper job, is it?
Callum McDonald is here from 4 o'clock because John isn't. So, Callum, what have you got to tell us?
We are keeping an eye on President Zelensky and his visit to the UK. We're expecting him to speak to MPs in our time on the air later on. So when that happens, you will hear that, of course, a little bit later on. The other thing we're reflecting today, actually, is two quite significant sort of national security interventions on Iran, and specifically, of course, the war in Iran. Two things to mention on this. So first of all, reporting this afternoon that Jonathan Powell, who is the UK's national security advisor, took part in those meetings that were happening, the negotiations really that were happening on Iran's nuclear programme, which, but to all intents and purposes, seemed to be progressing, albeit slowly. And then a couple of days later, Donald Trump and indeed Benjamin Netanyahu bombed Iran. So we've learned this afternoon that Jonathan Powell was present at those meetings, I think, which is intriguing because the reporting suggests that his take was that there was a deal to be done, albeit it was a work in progress, but there was a deal there to be made. Let's add that to news this afternoon that Joe Kent has resigned as the National Counterterrorism Center Director in Washington, a very senior Trump ally, Trump loyalist, who has stood down from a very significant role because he says, in his words, he cannot in good conscience support the war in Iran. There was no imminent threat, he says. And it's just quite interesting that we've got both of these things happening today. So we'll put all of that into context for you a little bit later on. Somebody we'll be hearing from, actually, is Dr. Artis Pabriks, who was the Minister of Foreign Affairs, Minister of Defence and Deputy Prime Minister of Latvia, for his considerations on where NATO sits in all of this. Latvia, their defence spending heading up towards 5% in the months ahead. And so we'll get his take on all of this too. And there is a Ukraine-UK chess match happening this afternoon among parliamentarians and political types. I don't believe so. She's been giving a speech this lunchtime. So I don't believe so. The strategic tactician wizard that she is. But we will be... I was going to say we'll be doing live commentary, which was really my ambition, but
Please
I don't think we can do that.
No, the excitement may be too much.
The airwaves. Yes, yeah. That's right. But we'll reflect on the Ukraine-UK chess match later.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Callum. Some squeals coming from next door. I don't know what's going on there. Callum, with you between 4 o'clock.
Chess.
Yeah, it's a talk of chess, yeah. Callum, with you between 4 and 7. Yes?
Elizabeth just sent us a text message. It just says, grow up.
She's not wrong. More than half of Gen X are in for huge shock when they retire, according to new research. 54% of people born between 1965 and 1980 are expected to have inadequate pension income. A third of Gen Xers won't have enough to meet a minimal standard of living. Most don't even know how much they've got in their pension pot. And that's if they have a pension pot, let's be honest. The Social Market Foundation carried out the research, and with us now is their chief economist. Welcome, Gideon Salatin. Thank you very much indeed for coming in. Really appreciate it. So these are people aged about what age now? Sort of
Gen X, they're born between 1965 and 1980. Yeah. They're between 45 and 60.
But they're people very much in the thick of professional and family life, aren't they? They've probably got all sorts of things on their mind. And now you're about to burden them with this terrible statistic. So what can you say to them? Any words of comfort at all?
Yes, absolutely. We are definitely writing this from a lens of urgency. I don't want to underplay that. Mm-hmm. But that's not to say that there aren't responses that people can take to improve their pensions. The first step, though, is admitting the problem. And the fundamental problem we were seeing is that most people are not engaging with their pension at all up until this point.
Okay, even if they're in their late 50s, they still haven't thought about it much.
That's where you start to see an uptick, but most people don't start thinking about this until at least their 40s, probably more like their 50s or even their 60s. By that time, they're waking up to a massive problem, and often there's not much time to do anything about it.
Okay, but what about auto-enrollment? Are they not positively impacted by that at all?
They absolutely are. No one's underplaying the impact of auto-enrollment. That was really useful. But bear in mind, Gen X is in a difficult spot. They were generally born too late to benefit from DB pensions. Those are what their parents enjoyed, those great old 20th century pensions where people had a fixed income for life. They were also born too early for auto-enrollment. Auto-enrollment was phased in between 2012 and 2018. By that point, a lot of Gen X had spent most of their working lives without it. Mm. Auto-enrollment has helped them out quite a lot in later in life, but they don't get the same benefits that, say, millennials or Gen Zers get who see auto-enrollment helping them out throughout their working career.
Okay, I mean, it used to be said that boomers were all right. I'm a boomer by about 6 months. Am I actually more all right than Gen Xers, or isn't there much difference?
I mean, it's all artificial to an extent, yeah. Right? An older Gen Xer has more in common with a young boomer than either
right,
have with
yeah.
the other ends.
Yeah.
What we see a big discrepancy on are two factors. What is their experience with the property market, and what is their experience with 2008? And both interact together. Older Gen Xers tend to have more property. They were able to get on the property ladder early, they paid lower fees, and they've been able to build up that equity. Mm-hmm. Younger Gen Xers, though, probably are much less likely to have a home themselves. They're also less likely to have paid it off already. A lot of them are still paying it. As you mentioned before, they're dealing with the costs there, high mortgage rates. If not, they're dealing with high rents. And so that's putting pressure on them as well. I mean, we spoke to about 50 Gen Xers. All of them mentioned struggling with costs. I mean, and they don't know how they can start investing in their pension when they're already dealing with these urgent costs.
Well, we were talking earlier in the office, and if you do have a bit of spare cash, or you're prepared to spare some cash, not necessarily the same thing, do you prioritise paying off your mortgage, or if you've got one, or do you bung it into a pension?
It would depend on your position. I'm not sure what rates they're paying. I'm not sure what rates they're going to get if they invest it. What I would say is if you want information on this and you are a Gen Xer, you can get free expert public advice through the government's Money and Pension Service, PensionWise program. If you're over 55, you're always eligible universally. And I found it immensely helpful with those who I've spoken to who have used it, because I don't want to comment on it myself.
Okay. Fee, do you want to ask a question?
Well, I think it's just so difficult, isn't it? There's a psychological element to all of this. And if you tell somebody who's in their 50s that there's kind of, they've left it too late, I think that the human condition goes, okay, well, I'm just going to leave it completely. It's a difficult one, isn't it? And there's no way of getting around the facts, and you're bringing us the facts, but the message just maybe has to get delivered in a slightly more hopeful way. Would you agree?
I completely agree. I also agree that a guy with a Canadian accent from a think tank is not the perfect person.
Not at all, Gideon.
No.
Neither of us would have said that.
But what I would say is how you deal with this messaging is critical, right? The reason that people have not engaged with their pension up to this point is to a large extent because they don't want to know. The Gen Xers that we spoke to, that we surveyed, they had a latent understanding that the retirement was not going to be rosy, but they hadn't gone to check. It's like someone who hasn't been to the dentist in a very long time. They know that things might not be good, but that's all the more reason to keep putting it off.
Yeah. Sorry.
Go on.
No, I just wanted to, if you've had, say, I don't know, over the course of a working life, maybe 6 or 7 different employers, you've probably got a pension of some sort with all of them or 3 of them. How do you get hold of that information?
It's scattered and it's difficult and it's a case-by-case basis and it's a massive problem at the moment. It's another thing that boomers and older people didn't have to experience, right? Mm-hmm. There was less job transition. These days, people have 7, I think, if you're lucky.
Often
people have many more jobs.
Right.
Consolidating is available. People can consolidate their pensions. Often they find it easier to do so. But I was just talking in my office about it. Many people have tried consolidating and it's difficult. I mean, Gen Xers, some of these jobs we're talking about are 25 years ago.
So by consolidating, we're just talking completely plain English. You're talking about bringing all those pots into one.
Exactly. You've got 7 scattered pots, bring it all into one roof, collect all those assets and manage them from there.
Does that actually pay off, or are you better off, I don't know, hedging your bets and having lots of different ones?
It pays off in the sense that it's much easier to keep track of. Bear in mind, when we say invest in a pension, we're going to keep the portfolio scattered no matter what. You may consolidate all of your assets under one roof, but you'll be investing in different branches anyway.
Okay, and if someone, if you work for Acme Inc. Back in the 1980s, they'll have a record of you. If they still exist. I mean, this is what used to really worry me. What if my employer had just gone bust and I did have a pension with them, or they just long since ceased to exist? What are my rights?
It happens. You can track them down. It is difficult. But there are billions lost right now in what we call lost pensions. People just don't understand where they are. The original employer may be gone. Maybe they've merged and merged again. And it can be difficult to track down.
But will they track you down if they've got your money?
No.
See, this is desperately depressing, Gideon. Help us out.
I'm sorry to hear it. There is work being done right now that is useful. A lot of people are already working on, as you say, getting those pots under one roof. But there's more that the government can be doing. We've been arguing for people to be able to see financial advisors for free, no matter their age. I mentioned that great service before, but it's only available if you're 55 and up. We're also looking at other options, improving auto-enrollment so that people end up paying more by default so that they're covered from the start.
Yeah. And what about the fact that some people might say, oh, you can just carry on working? You can carry on working if your employer allows you to, and if you're fortunate enough to enjoy your job and it basically involves sitting on your backside, you can carry on doing it. But it's not the case for everybody, is it?
It's not the case for everybody. And often these debates get into if you can carry on working if you're not working a manual job. But that doesn't apply to everyone. I mean, I spoke to teachers who say it's very difficult dealing with young kids as you get older. One thing that we're also pushing for is the government to improve the ability for people to work flexibly. Some people may want to work a little in their retirement, but not so much. Improve access to that and improve access to hybrid working. Let them work from home if they aren't able to get out and about as much.
Really fascinating. Thank you very much indeed, Gideon. Appreciate it. That's Gideon Salatin. We don't mind Canadians on the programme. We never have. We don't ban them or anything, do we? No, we're not discriminatory in the slightest.
Gideon's from the Social Market Foundation. Appreciate your help. Thank you.
Thank you for all of your lovely messages so far this afternoon. Francine says, no, don't ever, ever grow up. And Mark, who's listening to us in France, used to be an avid Radio 4 listener.
What?
I know. A pleasant surprise since moving my loyalty to Times Radio has been your show. Keep up the good work. So that makes up for the fact that we're in no uncertain terms told by one of our very regular listeners who we're very fond of to simply grow up. Coming up, we will get the latest on the meningitis outbreak in Canterbury. We're going to talk to our resident GP, Dr. Rachel Ward. We know that so many of you listening this afternoon will have real concerns about this story. So if you've got a specific question, I'm sure that Rachel will do her very best to answer it. You're listening to Jane and Fee on Times Radio with Wix. You can book your free design appointment at wix.co.uk.
Hugo Rifkind. on Times Radio with Elevon. Join Hugo every Monday to Thursday morning from 10 as he takes a sometimes serious and sometimes satirical look at the day's news, politics and culture, covering all the major stories making the headlines with in-depth analysis and exclusive interviews. Hugo Rifkind on Times Radio with Elevon. We support all payments for your business. Make one decision today. Visit elevon.co.uk.
The Story, the award-winning daily news podcast from The Times. Listen in the Times Radio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Dragged from his car at gunpoint in Syria, British photojournalist John Cantley vanished into the dark heart of ISIS. I'm Manveen Rana, and our podcast series, Last Man Standing, with The Times special correspondent Anthony Lloyd, investigates John Cantley's disappearance and inspired the gripping new BBC TV documentary, Hostage. Listen to the investigation that started it all. Search for Last Man Standing in your preferred podcast app.
Put a tool in Aaron Gemmell's hand, and he can fix just about anything. Put his business finances in front of him, and he wasn't so confident. A carpenter by trade, Aaron runs checklist property maintenance. He had all the right tools for the job, but not for his numbers. Invoicing, tax, paying suppliers, it all took time he didn't have. That's where Xero came in. Xero is the ultimate small business accounting tool in Aaron's kit. It gives him full control over everything financial, all in one place. As his business has grown, Xero has been a game changer, especially with meeting the new Making Tax Digital for Income Tax rules. It doesn't just help Aaron stay compliant, it gives him better visibility and control day to day. Xero even generates smart, professional quotes and invoices, which Aaron says gives him a competitive edge. Now Xero takes care of the numbers so Aaron can get back on the tools and get the job done right for his customers. With Xero, you can change the way you see MTD. Search MTD Ready.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, on the free Times Radio app, and on your smart speaker, Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio.
It's 12 minutes to three. The strain of meningitis, which has killed two young people in Kent, has been identified as the meningitis strain B. Speaking in the House of Commons earlier, the Health Secretary, Wes Streeting, called the outbreak unprecedented and announced a targeted vaccine programme.
Mr. Speaker, people are understandably asking about a vaccine. From 2015, the MenB vaccine has been available on the NHS as part of routine childhood immunisations, but clearly most students would not be vaccinated. Given the severity of the situation, I can confirm to the House that we will begin a targeted vaccination programme for students living in halls of residence at the University of Kent in Canterbury, which will begin in the coming days. UKHSA will provide further advice on other cohorts in the coming days. On the question of wider eligibility, we obviously follow the expert independent advice of the JCVI.
Well, that was Wes Streeting answering some of the questions that have been asked since this terrible outbreak has been identified. Let's talk about some more questions now with Dr. Rachel Ward, who is our resident GP, co-host of the Pharmacy Podcast. Dr. Ward, have you been inundated with calls to your GP practice about this?
Good afternoon. Yeah, I wouldn't say that we have been inundated. I think the news is really just starting to kind of settle in and people are starting to understand what's going on. And I suspect, however, over the coming days and weeks, we are going to be getting a lot of inquiries about vaccination. But also, I think in this situation where a serious illness has unfortunately been fatal, I think it brings it to the forefront of our minds. And I think people will be looking out for those symptoms and understandably feeling more anxious about it and asking us advice.
So let's just be very clear about the vaccination programme that was already available and who would have benefited from that.
So we started, when we're talking about meningitis B, the vaccination programme started in 2015 and we continue to do that. It vaccinates babies age 8 and 12 weeks and they have a booster at 1 year. Therefore, children that are over 11 will not have been included in this. However, I do remember at the time when this vaccine came out, many people did choose to go and get that vaccination privately if their child was older than the new inclusion criteria. So there will be older children who have it, but it certainly was not an NHS rollout.
Do we know, and I suppose by that I mean do you know, whether or not that very early years vaccination would still be protecting older children further down the line? Is that a known fact yet?
Yes, so we know that the at-risk groups is the very young children and then also older teenagers and young adults. So once you have had those three vaccinations in childhood, it very much does reduce your risk of serious disease. Like many, many vaccinations, it doesn't stop you from getting this infection, but it reduces the severity. And certainly since this programme started in 2015, we have seen a significant reduction in vaccinated children.
Are you simply more vulnerable as a teenager and young adult to all strains of meningitis?
So a lot of it is around the actual way that the disease is transmitted. So we often have, you know, we have seen outbreaks in the past in this age group as well. When people go to university, they're living in halls, they're mixing, you know, they're living in groups of multiple young people. They're going to events like nightclubs, like, you know, where they believe that this started to spread. And so a lot of it is related to the circumstances that you are in. And also in young children, that kind of, you know, being more vulnerable from an early immune system as well.
And what should any young person or teenager or parent of the above look out for in terms of symptoms?
Yeah. So I think the first thing to really, really say is that there is a whole variety of ways in which meningitis can present. And so do never be under the assumption, for example, that anybody is always going to present with that kind of high fever and non-blanching rash, because it's not the case. So I think, you know, the same goes for really any potential infectious illness, is that you are looking out for something that you think is potentially concerning. Something feels not quite right. So the symptoms are a high fever. You do frequently see this non-blanching rash. So when you press a glass over the rash on the skin, it does not reduce in colour. So that's something which you should, you know, should be aware of doing. People get severe headaches, which are worsening. They can be confused. They describe a stiff neck and not being able to look at lights because they feel uncomfortable. So we call that photophobia. They may be vomiting or having diarrhea. They may be kind of mottled on their skin or have very cold hands and feet. And in little babies, they may just be very irritated or not feeding. Or you may see that their fontanelle, their soft spot on their head, is bulging. I think what this tells you, I've just listed a whole range of symptoms, and nobody could be expected to, you know, to remember all of these. As always, you know, check out the list of symptoms on the NHS website. But if there is any shadow of a doubt, this is a medical emergency. This is not something that you phone your GP for. This is not something that you go to the pharmacist about. This is something that you phone 999 about and get advice.
Can you then be tested to see whether or not it is meningitis?
Yeah, so in many situations, so with meningitis, the most important thing is rapid treatment, and that's with antibiotics. So the testing, for example, is taking blood cultures, taking blood samples. That doesn't always happen before antibiotics are given, depending on the situation. So, for example, in my practice, we have a stock of antibiotics, which we would administer if we thought somebody had meningitis in the practice before they went to hospital and had the tests even, because we would act on it. But yes, as a general rule, if appropriate, people will have blood tests which can isolate the bug.
And are the antibiotics to deal with the meningitis or the possibility of sepsis?
So that's the same thing, really. So sepsis is caused by an overwhelming response to a bacterial infection that gets out of hand in your body. So antibiotics is one of those treatments. We give other treatments as well, you know, things like IV fluids and drugs which support people's circulatory system. So managing this kind of disease is very complex. And that's why it obviously takes part in hospital with lots of intensive support.
Our listener Fiona has asked, if I were to vaccinate privately now at the age of 15, could I boost again when going to university, or would it still be effective?
So what I would say is it vaccination is such a complex process now because children have so many vaccinations. It's going to be different for every person, and they would be looking at your current vaccine history to see what would be recommended and when, the age of the child and the boosters that are recommended. But my general feeling is that if you have a 15-year-old child and you're going to give them some vaccinations, you're going to have plenty of time to give them protection before that university age. Mm.
And your vaccine history should be on your NHS record, available via the app or only available via your GP?
A lot of that will appear. Again, it kind of depends on your age as to how much has been developed electronically with your vaccine history. But your GP, if it's not on the app, should hold a comprehensive vaccine history for anything done in the NHS or anything that's been, you know, informed from other agencies.
Okay. So if your child has had vaccinations provided on a school site, does that automatically get sent back to GPs? Because some schools do offer these programmes now, don't they?
Absolutely. So really important vaccine process happens in school. So the meningitis ACWY vaccine, that takes part in our near year 9-10 students. And yes, that is all linked in with the NHS vaccine programme. And that automatically gets added to your medical notes.
Should we be concerned that this outbreak in Canterbury could spread further?
So, of course, there is some concern, and that is why any contacts, people that have been potentially in contact with anybody with the infection, are being informed and asked to come out and get some antibiotics to try and reduce that spread. These are very virulent infections which spread quickly. I think the more days that we see, if we're not seeing the numbers rapidly increasing, we can start to, you know, hope that it's been contained. But I think at the moment, yeah, absolutely, there is work that we need to consider finding any contacts and giving them antibiotics.
Rachel, it's always good to talk to you. Thank you very much indeed. I know that you're taking time out of your busy day as a working GP, and we very much appreciate it. Dr. Rachel Ward is our resident GP, co-host of the Pharmacy Podcast. And any more news that we get, I mean, it's important news we've heard today from the Health Secretary about that targeted vaccine programme. We'll bring you any more news as and when we get it.
And just really quickly, if you want help with your pension, you go to the Money Helper PensionWise programme. Just stick it in your search engine. It should pop up. It's the gov.uk.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio, the voice of the times.
If I'd had more time, I'd have said, look out for the gov.uk, because when you put that in your search engine, Money Helper PensionWise, some other things pop up which aren't the approved gov ones. Make sure you're with the right one, because it looks like it's really helpful, that. Right, it's 3 o'clock. You're listening to Jane and Fee on Times Radio. And in the next hour, Israel says its military has killed Iran's security chief, Ali Larijani. We're going to talk to the US foreign policy expert, Barbara Slavin. The former India cricket captain has accused a team in Leeds of indirectly funding the killing of Indian soldiers. Vassos Alexander will have the very latest on that sports story for us. And today's big interview is with the chartered counselling psychologist and presenter Shan Williams, Dr. Shan Williams, discussing her new book, The Power of Anxiety. Let's get the news at three. Here's Stuart Willey.
Thank you. Good afternoon. Donald Trump's top counter-terrorism official has resigned over what he calls the lie driving the conflict in Iran. Joe Kent called on the president to reverse course, arguing Tehran poses no imminent threat to the US and claiming the conflict only began after pressure from Israel. Meanwhile, the foreign secretary has warned the government is extremely worried about the humanitarian consequences of Israel's operations in Lebanon. Yvette Cooper told the Commons, diplomatic progress can be made.
The UK is continuing our support for British nationals in the region, our defensive military support for partners against Iranian strikes, and our intensive diplomatic activity on both security and economic issues in the UK national interest. We will not be drawn into a wider war, nor will we outsource our foreign policy.
Pharmacies say they've seen a surge in bookings for the meningitis vaccine as the health secretary says the outbreak in Kent is unprecedented and developing rapidly. Wes Streeting says officials are planning a targeted vaccine program for students in halls of residence. Two young people have died so far, with 15 others seriously ill. GP Rosemary Leonard says many have the meningitis bacteria without being aware.
About one in four teenagers, young people, have the meningitis B strain living in the back of their throat, causing them no harm at all. But in somebody else, quite randomly, they can get invasive meningitis and sepsis. And it's the sepsis that is so, so devastating.
Rachel Reeves says we should remove trade barriers with the European Union. In a major speech, the Chancellor says deviating from EU rules should be the exception, not the norm. But she insisted the government won't be rejoining the customs union or reinstating freedom of movement. The security service, MI5, has apologised and will pay compensation to a woman abused by a neo-Nazi informant. Director General Sir Ken McCallum says they've settled her legal action without admission of liability. The agency faced criticism from judges for misleading courts after the agent was accused of coercive control and of attacking the woman with a machete. Gerry Adams has told a court he doesn't distance himself from the IRA, but that he was never a member of it. The former Sinn Féin leader is giving evidence in a civil case against him, which claims he's personally liable for bombings in London and Manchester. He denies any involvement in the attacks. And tributes are being paid to the thriller writer Len Deighton, who has died aged 92. Best known for The Ypres File, which was made into a film in 1965 starring Michael Caine, as well as 38 further books. The Times' literary editor, Robbie Millen, says he also wrote about French cuisine.
He definitely made cooking, you know, boiling an egg, look very interesting and stylish. But he stopped writing in his mid-60s. Mm. So I just think that's sort of 30 years of nothing. So which perhaps explains why he doesn't quite have the status as someone like Ian Fleming or John le Carré.
For a roundup of the news on demand, find the Times Radio News Briefing on the Times Radio app.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, on the Times Radio app, online, and on your smart speaker. Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wix Kitchens and Bathrooms.
It is Jane and Fee with you until 4 o'clock this afternoon. If you sometimes find that you cannot ride the worry wave of your own anxiety, then you will want to stay with us until 4 o'clock, because after 3:30, Dr. Shan Williams is going to talk about her new book, which is called The Power of Anxiety. It's quite a detailed handbook as to how to get through your daily life, making sure that you harness your anxiety as opposed to your anxiety harnessing you. And I think in these extremely difficult and troubled times, when whichever way you look, there's some kind of desperate problem, it's a book that you will want to hear more about. We're going to start with the very biggest news story of the day. Israel says Iran's security chief, Ali Lajani, has been killed in a strike. He was last seen in public at a Quds Day march in Tehran on Friday. Meanwhile, drones and rockets have reportedly been launched at the US embassy in Baghdad, raising fears of further regional escalation. The Strait of Hormuz remains closed, disrupting a critical global shipping route, and key US allies are so far resisting calls from Donald Trump to help reopen it. Well, let's talk about all of this with Barbara Slavin, foreign policy expert and former director of the Future of Iran Initiative. Barbara Slavin, a very good afternoon from us. Can you just explain a little bit what the Future of Iran Initiative was set up to do, is doing, and who's been part of it?
All right. First of all, thank you for having me. That's actually a project that I ran at the Atlantic Council, which I left 3 years ago. So it was formed in the hopes that we would see improved relations between the U.S. and Iran. This was in the run-up to the nuclear agreement that was negotiated by the Obama administration, Britain, France, Germany, China, Russia, and Iran. I left Atlantic Council. I'm now a distinguished fellow at the Stimson Center, where I've been working more broadly on the entire Middle East, but Iran remains a focus. I've been to the country 9 times, and I wrote a book about U.S.-Iran relations about 20 years ago. It is a very obviously tense and worrisome time. Talk about anxiety. My president has started a war, and I'm not sure he knows how to end it. And of course, the ramifications are being felt all around the globe.
So given your extraordinary knowledge of the region, the area, the key players and all of that, I mean, I'd just like to ask you where your anxiety is at the moment. For those of us who don't have such in-depth knowledge, I think it's sometimes quite hard to row back from a feeling of really severe impending doom. What do you think?
Well, look, this war will come to an end at some point. Since it was started by Donald Trump, at some point he will decide that he can declare victory and that the U.S. and Israel have done sufficient damage to Iran that it is not somehow a threat going forward. But this war was started without any imminent threat from Iran, and in an odd way, the threat may actually be greater when the war is over because Iran still has significant asymmetric capabilities. It used to be considered the premier state sponsor of terrorism. It can reconstitute drones and missiles. It can keep the Strait of Hormuz closed, really, as long as it likes, simply by threatening. That means that the insurance premiums will be sky high, and oil companies will not want to send oil through. Fertilizer companies will not want to send their cargoes through, which will affect food prices. So Trump and Bibi Netanyahu started this war, but Iran gets a say in when it ends.
When President Trump decides that he wants to declare victory, though, and as you say, that may well be at a time of his choosing. It probably isn't going to be at a time of the Iranian people's choosing. What would you expect to preempt that? At what point is he going to think, okay, I'm going to be able to stop now or walk back or appear to have won?
Well, I think a lot will have to do with pressure from his own base here in the United States. And today we already saw an extraordinary defection. The head of counterterrorism, the Counterterrorism Center, quit, blaming Trump and Israel for this war, saying there was no imminent threat and that he could not be part of this administration anymore. So that's kind of a first. I mean, Trump is known for firing people, but this is the first important defection from his administration. And we have also congressional testimony due later this week on the worldwide threat assessment, which is given annually. And we will have the head of the CIA. We will have the head of the National Intelligence Council, Tulsi Gabbard, who has been opposed to war with Iran throughout her career. So I think, you know, when the pressures from within, also the price of gasoline is going up at an astronomical rate. And that obviously is affecting lots of people. And we have midterm elections coming up in the United States in November. So I think domestic political pressures may be the most important in getting him to decide to declare victory, quote unquote.
Just tell us, Barbara, if you can, a little bit more about Joseph Kent. This is the guy you were referring to who announced his resignation today. And it is a stinging resignation letter full of rebuke for President Trump's policies, as you say, deciding to join with Israel in a war that Joseph Kent says should simply not have been countenanced. I mean, is he a big thing? Is he likely to take people with him? There are quite a few questions about his own past anyway, aren't there?
Yeah, apparently he's a fairly controversial figure. I'll be honest with you, I didn't know his name until he resigned. His mission, counterterrorism, I mean, we're already seeing concerns about anti-Semitic and Islamophobic acts of terrorism in the United States. These have been building since the Gaza war began following the Hamas attacks in 2023. So he may have had a variety of reasons for quitting now, but he is apparently considered an acolyte of Tulsi Gabbard, the director of national intelligence. And so a lot of people have been waiting to see if she might quit since Trump campaigned on a promise of no more stupid wars in the Middle East. So I think there's a lot of consternation up and down the so-called MAGA ranks, including within the administration, about the course that Trump has taken in his second term.
President Trump has been using the threat of NATO and his place within NATO. I mean, we have heard that before, haven't we, Barbara? Do you think that that significantly changes anything?
No, and I think the European response is pretty clear. I mean, after what Trump has put NATO and the European Union through, Greenland, et cetera, tariffs, why would anyone lift a finger to help him at this point? I mean, what more is he going to do that he hasn't already done? I think your prime minister has been fairly judicious in the way he's promised sort of defensive help, and Macron as well has promised, I believe, some defensive help. But Europe doesn't have the wherewithal, frankly, to open the Strait of Hormuz. It would be a huge lift even for the U.S. military. So I think his claims are outrageous, and that Europe, you know, should really say enough is enough, end the war, and then we'll help you with the mess that you've left behind, maybe.
What do we need to know, Barbara, about what is happening in Iran right now? I mean, obviously, from the get-go, President Trump was hoping that the Iranian people would help him in his victory, and that hasn't happened. Is that because of the entrenched fear of the current regime, the fact that there doesn't seem to be one person behind whom an awful lot of people can get? And also, presumably, the very simple practical point of you don't want to go out and demonstrate if there are bombs falling from the sky.
Yeah, I never took Trump's, claims that he was doing this on behalf of the Iranian people seriously. I mean, Trump would be perfectly happy to cut a deal if he could find someone to cut a deal with in Iran, and if Israel would stop killing potential partners for negotiations. I think it was he was exploiting Iranian misery at 47 years of this awful regime. He was really, and he started this war because Bibi Netanyahu told him Iran has never been so weak and we can degrade Iran. Maybe you can get a better deal, maybe not, but we can set it back substantially on your watch. Regime change, I think, was always a pipe dream. As you rightly point out, there is no recognized opposition leader behind whom the Iranian people could rally, even if they could safely come out in the streets. I mean, they're caught between American and Israeli bombs and their own repressive regime. And there's really no space for them right now. The space for change comes when you're in a peaceful situation and people have the wherewithal economically to come out and protest. And we've seen that in Iran. We saw that very prominently in 2009 with the Green Movement, after fraudulent elections. And of course, that was crushed by the Iranian regime. So I have not seen prospects for real reform in a long time in Iran. And again, there is no recognized alternative.
But Barbara, does it not become at least more likely that a recognized alternative can emerge the more members of the horrendous autocratic, theocratic regime are taken out, to use the modern parlance of warfare?
Well, we're not seeing it yet. What we're seeing is more hardline figures moving up. to head the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, which is the most powerful institution in Iran. The new supreme leader, the son of the old supreme leader, Mojtaba Khamenei, is very identified with repression and with the IRGC. The replacement for Ali Larijani, the national security advisor, could be a man named Saeed Jalili, who is a terrible negotiator, extremely ideological. During nuclear negotiations a decade or so ago, he used to begin by reciting all the past Iranian grievances against Britain, France, the United States, Russia, you name it. So I don't see it going in that direction now. I mean, at some point, hopefully, yes, but it could get much, much worse before it gets better.
Thank you very much indeed for joining us this afternoon. That's Barbara Slavin, foreign policy expert and former director of the Future of Iran Initiative.
It is 16 and a half minutes past three. And next, why is a cricket team based in Leeds being accused of funding the deaths of Indian soldiers? It's Jane and Fee on Times Radio with Wix, the experts in kitchens and bathrooms.
Kate Borsay on Times Radio.
Former US Navy Admiral James Fogo joins the evening edition to evaluate which countries are part of the International Naval Coalition to secure the Strait of Hormuz. Adam Bolton has the UK politics brief. Rachel Reeves may well bring us more on the UK-EU relationship. And we'll hear from Yvette Cooper after her discussions with US Secretary of State Marco Rubio. And joining us to discuss some of the biggest stories of the day, the columnist Ella Whelan and the Times' former diplomatic editor Michael Binion.
Kate Borsay, tonight from 7 on Times Radio.
Amazon offers term time working to their employees, like Anton, who's home to look after his daughters during their holidays.
Hello!
To him, this is the best sound in the world. Actually, maybe that's the best sound of all. Now that's term time working, offered at Amazon. 10 weeks off guaranteed per year. Mix of paid holiday and unpaid time off. Conditions apply.
I believe those who are curious see the world differently. At Viking, we have always been curious and quite a bit different. For over 25 years, we have been connecting the thinking person with the world. First on the great rivers, then on all five oceans, now on all seven continents. We are One Viking. Exploring the world in comfort.
Young people today, can they really handle responsibility? Or are we just kidding ourselves?
Welcome to McDonald's.
And a mayo chicken.
Some think young people can't manage. We disagree. That's why one in three McDonald's managers are under 25.
Hey, Kira.
Hey, girl. How are you?
All right? Yeah, I'm good. It's busy out there, though.
Like Kira from South London. She's 23 and manages a team of 20.
Let's go.
Leadership. Making it happen at McDonald's.
Listen to Times Radio on your DAB digital radio.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wix Kitchens. Choose from over 80 kitchen styles. Whether it's your first home or your forever home, find your dream kitchen at Wix. Prices start from under £3,000. Book your free design appointment at wix.co.uk.
Vassos Alexander is here. He's just moved. We were just talking about how difficult in midlife it is to move house, which is why I never will. And you haven't moved that far, have you?
I've moved from Barnes to Putney, less than a mile.
Less than a mile, but still quite hard to do.
Well, do you know what? It changes. You know, they say sometimes you should clean your teeth with your non-dominant hand because it just sort of changes stuff in your brain.
It's really good. It's as good as a rest.
It really is, you know. Yes. And just having different things as you step outside your front door, a different local cafe, a different shop where you buy the milk. It's really kind of invigorating, actually. Well, and Fee, you're about to find out.
I am about to find out. But just look at Jane's face. I don't like new milk. I don't like new coffee. I don't like anything. I just want to stay where I am.
Right, Susie has sent a message just saying that Barbara Slavin was very depressing. Well, I thought she was fascinating. I understand what you're saying, Susie. I mean, she really knew her stuff, but it was bleak.
Susie, both Jane and I said exactly the same we had said goodbye to her. Yeah. But I do think that kind of insightful expertise it is depressing, but it is absolutely what we need to hear at the moment, because the gung-ho language that is coming out of the White House about the war and about the victories and everybody being toast and all of that, you got to wear it up with the experience and insight of people who know Iran and also the Iranian people.
Yeah, I got the sense that she loved Iran as well, because it's an absolutely amazing country. So, yes, we should have more guests like Barbara, but we take your point, Susie, and it was, as V said, exactly what we said when the interview was over. Back to sport. The former India captain, Sunil Gavaskar, now he's weighed in, and this is actually quite serious, on a major diplomatic row in cricket. He's criticised the signing of the Pakistani spinner, Abra Ahmed, by Sunrisers Leeds, claiming that the deal indirectly contributes to the deaths of Indian civilians and soldiers. Indian-owned teams have avoided signing up Pakistani players since 2009 because of the tensions between the two countries. So it has made this £190,000 deal a bit controversial. Vassos, this is about the 100, which is a tournament based in the UK. Explain all, because cricket is not my area.
So, yes, a few years ago, the ECB launched this, this new format, the 100. Each team gets 100 balls to bowl at the other team, and it's actually been a big success.
Right.
So much so that the dominant commercial force in world cricket, the IPL, thought, do you know, we'll have a bit of that. And the England and Wales Cricket Board said, OK, fine, we will give some of those teams available for other franchises to buy. So what was the Oval Invincibles has now become the MI London team. There's a team in the IPL called the Mumbai Indians. So this is Mumbai Indians London, if you like.
Yep.
And the Northern Superchargers, as was, is now the Sunrisers, yeah, that's right, Leeds. There's a team in Hyderabad called the Sunrisers.
Oh, okay.
So it's a sort of, it's an offshoot of an IPL team. And as you say, since the Mumbai attacks of 2008, IPL teams have simply not signed Pakistani players. They were actually, and so the auction happened, so players go through an auction, and the £190,000 will be earned by Abra Ahmed.
For the season.
For the 3-4 weeks or whatever the season is of the,
okay,
of the 100. And there are actually two Pakistani players signed, but he was the one signed by an IPL-owned franchise in the UK. So there have been sort of rumblings about this. And since Sunil Gavaskar gave an interview this morning, that has rather exploded into full-scale controversy. Let me give you his quote. He is, just for people who don't know Sunil Gavaskar, he's in his 70s now. He was one of the great statesman-like opening batters of the men's Indian cricket team in the 70s and the 80s. I think he had a sort of sheriff of Mumbai kind of role over a few years. He's very vocal in the media, and when he speaks, people do listen. So this isn't just somebody shouting off. This is Sunil Gavaskar. He's like cricket royalty.
Right.
Here's his quote. The fees paid to a Pakistani player who then pays income tax to his government, which buys arms and weapons, directly contributing to the deaths of Indian soldiers and civilians.
Gosh, OK. I mean, there's no love lost between the two countries, is there?
No,
mildly.
No, exactly.
They do play each other at cricket, don't they?
Yes, they do. And so this is more like a sort of low-key ban of, I don't think it's an officially ban on Pakistani players in the IPL, but it's a, you know, so it's not like Russian teams being banned in the wake of the doping scandal and then more recently the war in Ukraine. This is just sort of like under the radar, but then suddenly, because of what's happened in an English Indian-owned franchise, this kind of, the, you know, the political tensions between India and Pakistan are very much, you know, in sharp focus.
Right. I mean, it's interesting. I didn't know these, what are they called, shadow bands? I didn't know they existed at all.
No. I mean, and I can't really think of any others. There are boycotts of Olympic Games. There are, you know, well, Iran aren't going to go to the World Cup as the Men's World Cup this summer in the USA, as things stand currently, although we understand there may be progress on that score today. But yeah, I mean, like a full-on shadow bans. I can't think of any others. The Russia football thing or the Russia sport thing is the only thing. But that's not a shadow ban. That's an outright ban.
Yeah, everybody knows about it. Mm. So, I mean, is he a particularly good player, Ahmed? And is it going to make a huge difference to Sunrisers Leeds?
So they're coached by Daniel Vettori, the New Zealand former player. I mean, yes, he's a very good player. I mean, they're willing to pay nearly £200,000 for his services, but you know,
yeah,
so yeah, he is a good player. He will, you know, he will. He's not the best player in world cricket. It's not like, you know, get Abra Ahmed under, you know, for any fee. But he's he is a good player.
And of course, they're a Yorkshire-based team, presumably,
mm-hmm.
and there will be a lot of Pakistani support there, I guess, because of some of the members of the local community.
Yeah, you would imagine so.
So they'll pack out the stands to see him. I mean, this 100 thing, it is one of those, it's a summer spectacular of lager quaffing and sunset entertainment.
It is exactly that.
Yes.
I was at the first game 5 years or so ago, which actually did involve the Oval Invincibles, now the MI London franchise.
Yes, I'm not really down with these names. I think they're trying hard, but, you know.
MI London. Come on, MI London.
No, it doesn't work. It just does not work.
But it is. It's exactly that. I mean, it's all done and dusted in a couple of hours. There's a lot of, like, fireworks and, you know, loud music and that sort of thing. And you know, people absolutely love it. I thought, why are you going from, you know, T20, which is 120 deliveries aside, to 100 deliveries aside, is that really necessary? And then where does it end? Why don't you just do a one ball shootout? But actually, it does work really nicely. And 100 is a much nicer round number for our heads to sort of get our heads around.
Yeah.
Is there quite a lot of MCC crossover here?
The sort of the bacon and egg ties.
Yeah. Are they in evidence in the stands?
They're not too many, no. But I think, you know, I wonder, because, you know, you go to the first test match of the summer at Lord's and they're queuing at 4:30 in the morning to get the best place in the, you know.
I think Times Radio takes a dip.
It almost certainly does. You did mention the Iranian men's football team. I thought we determined last week that they would not be taking part in the World Cup over the summer.
I thought we had two.
Right.
So the Iranian sports minister said we're probably not taking part. And then last week he said we're definitely not taking part. And Donald Trump has said it wouldn't be safe for them to take part. But according to the Iranian FA, talks are ongoing to move their matches. They've got two matches in Los Angeles and one match in Seattle, to Mexico, co-hosts of the World Cup. Mm-hmm. But as far as the Times understands, that ain't going to happen, because FIFA say, well, no, because tickets have already been sold. And where would we move other teams where tickets have already been sold? So it sort of can't happen. But according to the Iranian FA, they did qualify for the World Cup. It does feel like, you know, they would want to be there if they can. But then again, look what's going on.
It doesn't look
that last item.
Yeah, I don't. Based on our interview,
exactly.
3 o'clock,
yeah,
it seems unlikely. Mm. Well, Vassos, thank you very much. And I have to say, I'm not a fan of rugby. I did watch that game between France and
England. Oh my goodness!
I thought that was good. That was proper Saturday night entertainment. That
it absolutely was. When we were saying this time last week, 90 points were scored between France and Scotland, and this was 94 points, wasn't it, when that penalty
48,
went over.
46.
Yeah, 90. Well, it was just brilliant entertainment. You just didn't know which way it was going. And then with 90 seconds to go, England kicked the ball back to France. And you think, why did you do that? Because you now know France are going to win. Everyone in Dublin was watching on the edge of their seats, because if England had won or drawn, then Ireland would have won the Six Nations. Everyone in England was on the edge of their seats, because finally there is a team that's actually playing some good rugby after three terrible performances. And everyone in France obviously was on the edge of their seats in their sort of powder blue shirts.
I
which
like
were
those.
Yeah, me too. Yeah. You couldn't really tell the difference, but it worked well.
Yeah, never
it was
mind.
A
never
feast
mind that
of
I,
sport.
I couldn't actually tell the difference between the teams. I like that powder blue shirt. Very nice indeed. Vassos, thank you very much. We covered some ground there, didn't we?
Certainly did.
Yeah.
Seamlessly.
If you'd like more any of the stories that Vassos discussed, you can go to thetimes.com and just go to the sports section.
They sold out within 8 minutes of those powder blue shirts.
Yeah, the French.
There's now a
four-week
waiting list for them.
Is there?
Mm.
I think I'd be a medium.
Don't look at me. I've already got your birthday present. No, I haven't. Coming up, we'll be joined by presenter and chartered counselling psychologist Sian Williams discussing her latest book, which is called The Power of Anxiety. It's just gone 3:30. Let's get a check on the latest news headlines first with Stuart Willey.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio.
Thank you. Good afternoon. Donald Trump says the US no longer needs or desires assistance from allies in the Strait of Hormuz. In a post on social media, he said many NATO allies had refused to get involved in operations against Iran. It comes as the president's senior counter-terrorism official has resigned over the war. Joe Kent says he cannot in good conscience support the conflict, with the Islamic Republic posing no imminent threat to the US. Here, the health secretary says the meningitis B vaccine will be offered to some students at the University of Kent. Two people in the surrounding area have died from the infection, including a Year 13 pupil. Wes Streeting told the Commons the number of confirmed cases has risen to 15. Eleanor Hayward is health editor of The Times.
If you're a student, you're living in quite cramped quarters often, you're going out clubbing, people sharing vapes, and that might be spreading meningitis. That lifestyle also means that meningitis is more like to spread through students. So there's kind of two age groups where people tend to get meningitis, and that's either really young babies, children, or teenagers, students.
Gerry Adams insists he had no involvement whatsoever with the IRA. The former Sinn Féin leaders denied being behind any bombings in the UK as part of a civil case against him. Scotland could be the first country in the UK to legalise assisted suicide later. A final vote at Holyrood is due to take place tonight. And Bentley is warning around 275 jobs are at risk as the carmaker restructures. Don't forget, you can set the Times Radio News Briefing as your news service on Alexa.
This is Times Radio.
Tesco Insurance are driving down the cost of motoring with 10% off car insurance. Take out a car insurance policy before the 15th of May 2026 and you'll get 10% off with club card prices. We offer a range of cover options so you can choose the one that's right for you. Save 10% when you buy or renew a car policy with Tesco Insurance. Search Tesco Car Insurance and get a quote direct today. Club card required. Excludes add-ons. T's and C's apply.
Data across the UK and EU.
Jane Garvey and Fig Lover on Times Radio with Wix Kitchens, helping create kitchens to feel proud of. From expert design consultants who'll measure your space and bring your vision to life on a 3D plan, through to a professional installation service. Learn more at wix.co.uk.
It is 3:33. I can't do that. What is that in other time?
It's almost 25 to 4.
Thank you. That's great. Anxiety disorders are the world's most common mental health issue, affecting a third of a billion people, and yet we still don't seem to have truly effective and easily available ways of managing them. That's what Dr. Sian Williams tells us in her latest book, written in her capacity as a practicing counselling psychologist. The book is called The Power of Anxiety: How to Ride the Worry Wave, and in it she helps us to understand this perfectly natural mental state, which is good for us when it's working in balance with the rest of our lives, but can be absurdly damaging when it isn't. Dr. Sian is here now. Hello. How are you?
I'm all right. Are you asking me how are you in these uncertain and difficult and very anxious times?
Yes, I am.
I was just listening to your guest. Yeah. Before that you had, he was talking about the situation in Iran, and I know people were getting in touch saying, oof, you know, that's a lot. And I think we are living in uncertain, unpredictable times, and it can be hard to know what to do when you feel powerless. And when, you know, obviously for some people it's a lot closer, isn't it, what's going on, because they might have people that they know in Iran, they might be from Iran, there might be very close connections, in which case that's a particular level of anxiety, not knowing what's going on, wanting to connect with family. But I think we're knowing about all the repercussions or potential repercussions as well, you know, the effect on petrol and oil and perhaps shortages coming up in the shops, we don't know, but with the Straits of Hormuz being as they are. So there are lots of understandable and very valid reasons why people would go, how do I manage this? How do I manage this lack of control, this lack of certainty? And what the brain does when there's a vacuum is it tries to find answers, and it tries to come up with best case or worst case scenarios. So it will just sort of go through all the what ifs. And there's a danger that then you fall into catastrophizing or ruminating. and typically do one of two things to manage it. The first is to just sink yourself into news and be completely hypervigilant, which isn't always helpful. You know, we've all worked in news. Sometimes you need to step away. Sometimes you need to make sure, A, trusted sources, but B, you have time to go, and now I'm connecting with the life I have, the family I have, the community I have. Or the other, the alternative position is to ignore it altogether. And that's not great either, because that can lead to isolation and withdrawal. So I think how you deal with war uncertainty, or how you deal with any uncertainty, is you notice that it's coming up. Where's my head going? What's coming up for me in my body? What am I doing to try to mitigate it in my behaviour? Notice it, name it. Just by naming it gives you a pause where you can stand outside it and sort of be a bit more curious towards it. You can do something in that space and then act. And it's controlling the controllables. So it's do what you can do. And that might be re-establishing a routine. It might be connecting with your community. It might be doing something smaller scale that you feel you can control.
You put quite a lot of personal anecdotage into the book, because anxiety and you have at times been quite close mates, haven't they? And you do tell us right at the beginning of the book about an extraordinary episode where you fell off a stool when you were working for the BBC, and the place that you were working in, the situation that you were in, just became overwhelming, and you probably hadn't had enough to eat that day and it was hot and all of the rest of it. But it's quite a telling anecdote, I think, because there's quite a lot of me when I read that. I just thought, oh, Sian, you should have just stopped. What a terrible thing to have happened. So talk us through what happened and why you didn't stop, why you carried on in that environment.
Well, listen, we're all broadcasters and we will all have experienced anxiety. And frankly, if we haven't, then we shouldn't be in the job. There is something that will come up for us. You know, when somebody says to you, Fee, right, you're interviewing whatever, cabinet minister, prime minister, or you're coming up, when you're at Radio 4 and you're coming up to the pips and you've not done it before and you've got to make sure that you hit perfect
pips.
The pips.
It's been triggered. there
we go. You know, we all have occasions when the adrenaline and the cortisol is going a bit bonkers. And I don't want to overplay the anxiety I felt at all. So the book isn't about me. There are a couple of little bits in there, but it's not about me. Anxiety is something we all have and we all need, because it's essential. It's a clinical necessity. It's there to keep us safe and protect us from danger. It's sometimes when it's switched on, when it doesn't need to be switched on, and that's when it's less helpful. And the occasion when I was sitting on the tall stool doing the
Which is actually very cool. Jane and I have got a thing about stools.
Okay.
We're quite often asked to perch
on
them.
Don't tell the story about when we were falling off one.
No. Did you fall off one as well?
Yes, and I had a few drinks.
Okay.
I actually wasn't.
Oh, sorry. Okay.
Were you on air?
No, we were on a jolly, actually, with work. Anyway, okay. Carry on.
But we're all about the same height.
It's a very cruel piece of furniture for a short woman.
It's a cruel piece of furniture for a woman who's 5'2". Yeah. Let's put that out there.
Yeah.
And yes, it was a hot day, and yes, I hadn't eaten, and all these things. But sometimes as well, you know, your resources aren't enough for you to deal with the thing, whatever the thing is. The feed of pictures to my feet that I was looking at, that I was meant to be commentating on, suddenly disappeared, and I had to commentate on pictures I couldn't see. So that was a challenge, to say the least. Fell off the stool, had a bit of a faint, given some custard creams, back on the stool, away you go. Because the programme still had to be done, right? We still had to present a show, and it was dealable with. You know, in the NHS, I work with people where anxiety robs them of their sense of self, and where they can't work and they can't go out and their relationships are compromised. And anxiety didn't affect me in that way. It is nothing to be ashamed of, and it is manageable, and we can work with it, and it can still be present. And sometimes it needs to be, and that's also okay.
Tell us about dandelions versus orchids.
Yes, what are you? Can I ask first? Have you done the quiz?
Yes, so the orchid is the more sensitive flower in the
Indeed.
Room, the one that's feeling more things, that I suppose might be a little less robust than the dandelion, I am definitely veering towards orchid. Mm. So I feel the news quite in quite a kind of personal way sometimes. Mm-hmm. And sometimes I have looked around newsrooms and thought, oh, yeah, that person over there is just flying off them. You know, it just doesn't touch them at all, the fact that they're talking to someone whose child has just died. Mm. And I've always been very aware that, you know, I've been of a more sensitive disposition. And I was quite heartened, actually, to read in the book that, you know, you can really self-identify as that and really be quite chuffed about it.
I would be quite chuffed about it. Although I think we're all of a similar age where perhaps growing up we were told not to be sensitive, grow a thicker skin. If you're going into journalism, you can't be sensitive because things will get to you too much, etc., etc. I think the most empathic journalists and therapists and are those who are most sensitive, because you simply are open to more of the stuff the world throws at you. But that means, I think, you bring a different understanding and compassion to it. Mm. So you will listen and you will engage and interact in ways that perhaps a dandelion, who's thought to be sort of more robust, you know, dandelions are those flowers who pop up everywhere and through dry soil and they're always there and perky, perky. And orchids are much more, I guess, much more affected by their environment. So if it's the wrong environment, or if something feels out of kilter, they feel it very deeply. But on the positive side, the orchids are also more adaptable, more creative, more intuitive. They think and process stuff deeply, which is why you say you can feel stuff and you'll look at others and think, why is it just, why aren't they taking this home? Or why is it not affecting them in the same way? It's because things will get to you more, and that is also a strength, because that will make you an empathic, compassionate, listening, engaging person.
I tell you what is difficult at the moment is the fact that the world is full of hard men doing bad things, bad men doing hard things. Mm-hmm. It's not necessarily because they're men, or maybe it is, but it's quite a brutal world that we're looking at, and we're looking at it increasingly through a lens of war. And I think that kind of compassionate aspect then becomes incredibly difficult, A, because what we're seeing all around us, and this isn't about me at all, it's everybody, we are seeing some real desperate situations that, as you've already alluded to, we cannot really process as individuals. And we might not feel that we have anything in common with the people who are in charge.
Yeah, that is a really interesting point. I think the very business of being in news means that you are filtering the worst of what's going on in the world, because you have to, because that's what news is. And I think going back to what we were saying before, which is the importance of curiosity, connection, compassion, connecting with things that are meaningful to you, that play into your values, you know, and that might be in your local community. That is why it is so important. And that stuff is still out there. You know, good people doing great things are out there. But at the moment, it feels like there's an imbalance, because what we hear and what we see is the negative stuff. And remember that the brain is primed to react to and look for the negative, because we need to be primed for danger. That's why we scan the horizon, looking for the next threat that's going to come around the corner. I just, in the past hour, I got an email from my daughter's school. We live in Kent, alerting us to the meningitis outbreak that's been happening there. You know, that's another thing that you can throw into the mix. But I also know that there are amazing amounts of wonderful stuff happening in the area where I live and with people that I know, that we need to purposefully, cognitively sort of rewire our thinking to seek out the things that best support us during this time. And we might have to put more effort into it, because the brain will be looking at the negative. So it's, what can I do in this instance to support me, my family, my friends, the people I love?
So we're all hopefully capable of making those decisions. Obviously, when you're very young, you're not. Yeah. And we have an anxiety epidemic amongst our young people. I mean, this is a book aimed at adults, but it could be read by young people as well.
Yeah, and it is being, yeah.
Yeah. Why aren't we managing to adapt to all of these new threats in the world in the way that our predecessors must have adapted to their threats in order to survive? Is there simply something different in the world of social media, algorithms chasing us down, our connection to the digital that has really flummoxed us?
I think there are a couple of things going on here. The first is, not to say that previous generations were not anxious, but they might not have had the words or the ability or the, I guess, the freedom to express that with the stigma that's often attached to it. I think it was a lot more difficult to say, I feel this and can you help me? I mean, I know certainly just, you know, from my generation, and you're a bit younger, but emotions weren't expressed at all, and especially not in the industry we work in. I think there's, so it's partly that, it's partly having the language for it and understanding of it. And I just think the other thing is that younger people are facing different things to the things that we perhaps were facing. So there is, yes, financial insecurity. You know, there's a student loans crisis. Will they ever get onto the housing ladder? There's climate anxiety. There's an interesting study in the book about climate anxiety, actually, which might illustrate the point, which is those who have higher levels of climate anxiety, the young people, are more likely to engage in proactive things to improve their environment, even on a small scale. So in other words, if you are feeling this stuff intensely, a lot of people will say, what can I do in this area? Even if it feels small, what small steps can I take? And that can alleviate their individual anxiety and make them feel a little more comfortable with an uncomfortable situation.
This has just come in from Guy, who says, as a 27-year-old chap, the discussion on empathy and emotional sensitivity is lovely to hear. I've always been somewhat ashamed of this feeling more emotive than others when you're told to be tough and to be insensitive. Mm. Tom is not enjoying our conversation at all.
Oh, dear.
Ending up saying, now it's the patriarchy who's at fault. Hard me, for goodness sake. Well, I mean, the thing is, Tom, it's just a fact that there are more men in charge at the moment than women. And actually, there's just a very interesting passage in your book about Jacinda Ardern and what she hoped to leave to the world of politics.
Yeah.
And she was quite often criticised and ridiculed for being empathetic and compassionate first, but that was her decision and her way to lead, wasn't
yes, it? Yes, and I think, you know, the former New Zealand Prime Minister, who did face obviously COVID and Christchurch and all those sorts of things she had to face during her premiership. And she brought a level of compassion to what she was doing. And that really helped, I think, with people understanding that there is somebody here to support us through these tough times. I get what Tom was saying. I don't think you were slagging off men when you were talking about this. I think it was more a case of, It's the feeling of not being in control of
yes.
of things,
oh, no,
which comes up, and that can be anybody. Who
yes,
makes you feel
and
like
and
that.
God knows, you know, I love a man, probably too many of them. Right,
and that's something I'd like to pick up with you, Finn.
And that's a book I'd like to read
if you have another hour.
No,
let's
I don't.
Explore that.
Callum's coming. You mentioned Finland, the country tops happiness polls. Now, why does it?
Well, so my son and I went to Finland. We went to see the Northern Lights. It was a big birthday for him and a big birthday for me. And it's an extraordinary place. And actually, while we were there, once again, it topped the world's happiness ratings. It's based on a question. Well, actually, it's based on something called the Cantrell ladder, which is, if you were to place yourself somewhere on a ladder where the rungs go from 1 to 10, based on your best or worst possible life, where would you put yourself? So it's one question. And they ask 140 countries, and Finland has come out on top several years in a row. And I think it always seems to be coming out on top. So I thought, what is it about Finland that leads to them being a happier nation? Are they actually a happier nation? If it's based on one question, that's quite hard, isn't it? Where would you put yourself on a ladder with 10 rungs? Are you a 7? Are you a 6? Were you a 5 yesterday? Might you be an 8 tomorrow? I think it's more to do with they have a lot of nature, and we know that when we engage with nature, our levels of anxiety can go down. they are much more engaged in a community aspect. So there was a study about if you drop your wallet in a country, do you have on a street, do you have confidence that somebody will pick that wallet up and give it back to you? And in Finland, they do. They have more trust in their institutions than, say, for example, we do. We don't have much trust in our public institutions. The Finns do. They have media literacy. So, you know, we were talking about sort of navigating the news and how younger people can navigate the news. They teach their young people how to navigate news, which sources to go to, you know, how to best protect themselves. That's a really important. So younger people are taught very early on, this stuff is difficult, how best to navigate and work with it. So I think there are various things that they do. Whether they're the happiest nation on earth, I mean, who knows? There's also a lot of other stuff that goes on in Finland that doesn't lead to a happier nation. And that metric can be quite binary and quite linear. But I think in terms of pursuing happiness, I guess the point of writing about this was to say, if we're pursuing individual happiness, we know that the research suggests that those who pursue individual happiness are likely to be less happy. If we explore it from a sort of more community aspect, then it leads to greater happiness. So in other words, if you do nice things for other people, you feel happier and more content, yeah, which leads to a better society.
When should you recognise that your anxiety is actually becoming dangerous to you or to others around you?
I think by the time I see people in the NHS, and I work with a lot of emergency responders, so firefighters, ambulance workers, police officers I work a lot with as well, is by the time they get to you, they're often sick. So they're often ill and perhaps don't realise it themselves, but something in their life has broken down. So perhaps their relationships aren't working, that it's hard for them to engage in the life that they love. So they've perhaps lost joy and pleasures in life. They're finding it really hard to work. There might be burnout. So there can be lots of different things that are coming in. It can be quite hard to notice that in yourself, which is why I say you can't outthink your anxiety. You have to sort of be where it is and feel where it's coming up in your body and see what your behaviour is like. If things have changed for you, if you're no longer finding joy in the things you used to, if you're finding it difficult to connect with the people you love, that is something where you might think, there's something going on here that I need to pay attention to. And time to really, really look at what it is and how it's affecting your life. And then I think it's a question of going, when did this start? How did it start? Who's there for you? Who's supporting you? There are lots of important questions to ask. Mm. So what happened to you? It's never what's wrong with you. When I sit with, it's never what's wrong with you, because it's not wrong. It's that things have perhaps conspired against somebody and now they're in a situation where it's they don't know how to get out themselves. And in psychology, you kind of are with somebody helping them navigate all that and equipping them with the tools to go back to the life or to live a different life, but one that they deserve to have, one that has meaning for them.
You're practicing within the NHS. Obviously, we hear too many stories about the lack of funding available and therefore mm-hmm. the lack of places available for people to go if they're struggling with their mental health. Do you believe that you are seeing people too far down the line because of that lack of availability, lack of funding?
I don't know whether it's a lack of availability and lack of funding. I believe in a more proactive way of managing mental health. So it's, if you think of it like a stream going towards a waterfall, what you don't want is to go over the waterfall and to be picking people up in bits at the bottom, because putting people back together when things have drastically fallen apart takes longer and is harder. I think if we can, and that was the point of the book, is if you can best equip people with the knowledge and the tools and the insight to know what it is that is affecting them or making them feel in a particular way, and how best they can live well with that, and how they can, what tools and tips they can use when, you know, when they're trying to surf the wave, as it is, then that is the most important. That means that you can protect yourself rather than get to the stage where you're burnt out and you're struggling.
Yeah. Well, my little dandelion puff, any questions from you?
Well, no, I mean, people asking, can you just choose not to be anxious? You can't, can you?
No, and I don't think we should. I think we need to have a different way of looking at anxiety because it is, if we see it as something that is not our fault, it is there to keep us safe. It's just sometimes it misreads the room. Sometimes it just gets stuff wrong. And sometimes actually that can be down to things that are quite, I wouldn't say easy to fix, but are less entrenched. So, for example, I don't do well with caffeine. So I don't drink coffee anymore. Really like coffee, don't do well with it. I'm sort of caffeine sensitive. There are certain things, caffeine, it might be hormones, it might be sugar, it might be certain things that you can tweak, you know, better routine, better sleep, et cetera, et cetera. And there are other things which are a little more sticky, which might go back to childhood or things that you need to really look at. But don't push away your anxiety. Pushing it away makes it bigger. Outside, I was talking to a woman in her 30s who was saying, feels like sometimes you're in quicksand. If you struggle in quicksand, it's going to pull you in. You need to just go with it a bit. Or the quote on the front cover is from Jon Kabat-Zinn, who's a mindfulness expert, who says, you can't stop the waves, but you can learn to surf. You know, the waves of anxiety are always going to be there, but we can learn to navigate and surf them well, I think.
Lovely to see you, Sian. Thank you very much indeed for coming in. Dr. Sian Williams' latest book is called The Power of Anxiety, How to Ride the Worry Wave.
You are with Times Radio. It's 4:03.
Times Radio, Market Watch, in association with FNC Investment Trust. Listen to Times Radio to hear all the latest financial news from all the global stock markets. Get insight, analysis, and up-to-the-minute information to help you get the most from your investment portfolio. Times Radio, Market Watch. Throughout the day, every Monday to Friday, on Times Radio, in association with FNC. It's smart to start with FNC. Find out more at fnc.com. Capital at risk.
Coming soon, rowing's greatest rivalry, live and exclusively on Times Radio.
I believe those who are curious see the world differently. At Viking, we have always been curious and quite a bit different. For over 25 years, we have been connecting the thinking person with the world. First on the great rivers, then on all five oceans, now on all seven continents. We are One Viking. Exploring the world in comfort.
Stop it.
At QuickFit, our customers drive away happy every time.
Get up.
Do we tickle their feet?
Stop.
No.
Oh, all right.
We just do our job, like having an excellent range of tyres to suit every car on the road.
Oh, that's good to know.
That's why our customers drive away happy. Quick Fit. Drive away happy every time.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, on the free Times Radio app, and on your smart speaker, Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio.
We're here on Times Radio with Wix. Book your free design appointment at wix.co.uk. Dr. Sian Williams, what's the name of that book, Fee?
It's called The Power of Anxiety.
Yeah, she was talking about anxiety, and the man who makes all of us anxious is on all the news channels right now. It's You Know Who in conversation with the Taoiseach for St. Patrick's Day. And he's offering reassurance of a sort, which Callum McDonald can sink his gnashers into here on Times Radio between 4 o'clock and seven. Who do we want to thank today?
We would like to thank Felix Forbes, Hannah Quinn and Ryan Boyden.
Have a very, very good evening.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio, the voice of the times.
Thank you, Jane. Thank you, Fee. Hello, good afternoon. It's 4 o'clock. This is Callum McDonald sitting in for John Pienaar on Times Radio Drive. The headlines: President Trump says the US no longer needs or desires assistance from allies in the Strait of Hormuz. And the Health Secretary, Wes Streeting, says the meningitis B vaccine will be offered to some students at the University of Kent. Coming up, as one of Donald Trump's counter-terror chiefs resigns over the war in Iran and the IDF claims to have killed Iran's top security official, we'll get the thoughts of former National Security Advisor in the UK, Lord Ricketts. And could the US's European allies intervene to help America reopen the Straits of Hormuz? Or actually, will the German leader's announcement that this is not NATO's war continue to define Europe's approach?
This is Times Radio.
Now, the news here, Stuart Willey.
Callum, thank you. Good afternoon. Donald Trump's top counterterrorism official has resigned over what he calls the lie driving the conflict in Iran. Joe Kent called on the president to reverse course, arguing Tehran poses no imminent threat to the US and claiming the conflict only began after pressure from Israel. It comes as the US president says they no longer need or desire assistance from allies in the Strait of Hormuz. In the last few moments, he said many NATO allies had refused to get involved.
NATO's making a very foolish mistake. And I've long said that, you know, I wonder whether or not NATO would ever be there for us. So this was a great test because we don't need them, but they should have been there.
Gina Abercrombie-Winstanley is a former U.S. diplomat now with the Atlantic Council. She told Times Radio the majority of Americans don't support the war.
Americans recognize the importance of allies, even if the president doesn't hold that thought at all times. He does. And of course, the fact that he has to call on them even now shows him how valuable they are. The challenge, of course, is that he did not do the prep work.
Here, the health secretary has defended the government's response to the Kent meningitis outbreak, as he calls it unprecedented. Two young people have died so far, with 15 others seriously ill. Pharmacies say they've seen a surge in bookings for the meningitis jab, as Wes Streeting says officials are planning a targeted vaccine program for students in halls of residence.
What we've seen in recent days is unprecedented in terms of the extent of transmission and the pace at which it's occurred. We've already sadly lost two young people, and I cannot begin to imagine what those families are going through.
Jerry Adams has denied taking an oath of allegiance to the IRA. He's being sued by three bombing victims who claim he was a leading member of the terror group and are seeking £1 in damages. Mr. Adams has always denied being part of the organisation. The security service MI5 has apologised and will pay compensation to a woman abused by a neo-Nazi informant. Director General Sir Ken McCallum says they've settled her legal action without admission of liability. The agency faced criticism from judges for misleading the courts after the agent was accused of coercive control and of attacking the woman with a machete. Rachel Reeve says we should align more with the EU to trade more. In a major speech, the Chancellor says deviating from European rules should be the exception. But she insisted the government won't be rejoining the customs union or reinstating freedom of movement. Reform UK's economic spokesman Robert Jenrick says his party's policies wouldn't be possible without Brexit.
We're going to scrap the heating tax, which is the VAT that you pay on domestic fuel. It's not been possible whilst we were part of the EU, but it's a Brexit benefit that we can actually get rid of this. And so we're going to scrap it for everyone.
And for a news bulletin when you want it, search for the Times Radio News Briefing on the Times Radio app.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, on the free Times Radio app, and via your smart speaker. Times Radio Drive with ServiceNow.
Hello, good afternoon. It's 4 minutes past four on Tuesday, the 17th of March. This is Callum McDonald in for John Pienaar today with Times Radio Drive. The outbreak of war in Iran, had it occurred in 2022 or 2023, might have given Ukraine a battlefield advantage. At that time, Russia was heavily reliant on Iran for the inexpensive Shahed one-way attack drones that have proven highly effective in Ukraine. However, the situation has now changed. Russia is reportedly producing thousands of its own version of the Shahed every year. This domestic production capability has reduced Russia's dependence on its Middle Eastern ally. Conversely, officials have indicated that American munitions intended for Ukraine, including critical systems like Patriot missile interceptors, could be redirected to the Middle East due to the Iran conflict. It is a critical time for the attention of the US to be on the Middle East and for Russia to gain. Oil and gas, the lifeblood of Russia's economy, have both rocketed in price. Sanctions have been weakened and the Western alliance, such as it is, has been distracted by the latest Trump peace project. As 2026 began, the data for Vladimir Putin was bleak. Russian oil and gas revenues had plummeted to a four-year low, and January's budget deficit alone swallowed nearly half of the government's entire yearly target. The National Welfare Fund, once Putin's rainy day fortress, was being drained at a rate that suggested that the end of it was finally in sight. The war with Iran has changed the entire picture, and in dramatic fashion. Almost overnight, the closure of the Strait of Hormuz turned a global crisis into a Russian lifeline. With 20% of the world's oil supply effectively stranded, the market has performed a desperate pivot. Today, the ethics, legality and necessity, as well as the repercussions of the war in Iran, are under examination again. The steadfastness of the NATO alliance is under renewed scrutiny, and President Zelensky is visiting the UK to hear renewed rhetoric about support for his country in the face of the now bountiful Russian aggressor. All of this to be considered this afternoon on Times Radio Drive. I'm Callum MacDonald. It's claimed the UK's National Security Advisor, Jonathan Powell, attended the final talks between the US and Iran, and he considered Tehran offered enough to prevent a rush to war. In fact, it's reported he thought the deal was surprising. It was 2 days after those talks ended, with further talks planned, that the US and Israel launched the attack on Iran. These reports of Jonathan Powell's involvement go some way to explaining the government's reluctance to get involved in the early days of the bombing campaign, about which President Trump is speaking in the Oval Office.
Say that I'm not exactly thrilled when we help them with Ukraine. Look, Ukraine would have been over in 1 day if we didn't help. Frankly, Ukraine would have been over in the first day. They had the best equipment in the world. It was our equipment given by sleepy Joe Biden. No charge. Hundreds of billions of dollars of the best equipment in the world. No charge. I will say that I'm not happy about it.
Mr. President.
One on Iran and one on Cuba. Is Iran now a bigger foreign policy priority for you than China? And on Cuba, the Cuban government?
Iran is just a military operation to me. Iran is something that was essentially largely over in 2 or 3 days. Because the Navy was wiped out almost immediately. The Air Force came next. The anti-aircraft came next. I mean, we're flying over Iran. We could take out their electric capacity in 1 hour. We have all the... there's nothing they can do right now because everything is knocked out. They have no... again, no radar, no anti-aircraft. They have nothing.